I'd like to welcome you to this podcast today. I'm Francis Seely from Global Debt 21, and this is one of the many podcasts we do, which looks at global, national, and local issues. And today we're going to look at what is an issue in a nation state, but also a global issue, and that's climate change. And we're going to look at how a particular organization engages young people and what we can learn from that. And we have got with us Jasmine Saunders, and she's from a group called Our Climate. She's only been in there for 1 month, so it'll be interesting to see what she has to say about that. So, you know, Jasmine, thank you very much for joining us all the way from Washington, which I know is even hotter than it is here. And so maybe in the heat, though, I'm sure you have air conditioning. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and your commitment to tackling climate change?
Yeah, thank you so much, Francis, for having me. I grew up in Monroe, Louisiana. Louisiana is also known for Cancer Alley. So this is the combination of oil and various factories then affecting people's health. I grew up seeing the disproportionate impacts of climate change on communities of color and the disappearing coast of Louisiana. This disappearing coast affects not only the physical of Louisiana, but also the culture. And that really prompted me to study biology and then go on to get my graduate studies at the University of Essex in Colchester, England, for a Master's of Science in Tropical Marine Biology with a specialty in climate change. I have conducted research in Indonesia and worked heavily with the Bajo people there. And I then came back to DC to work on climate change advocacy after realizing that I love to advocate on behalf of those who no longer have a voice or who need an elevated voice to speak up on a certain issue. And so I am now with Our Climate as their new executive director.
Okay, well, you obviously had quite a wide background already. We're going to talk about some of the issues you raised as we continue the interview, but you are now the new CEO of Our Climate. What is our climate and what does it do?
Yeah, so Our Climate is a climate change youth advocacy organization. It started off as a state campaign in Oregon in 2013, and then we transitioned to a national campaign. So since the Put a Price on It campaign launch in 2016, we've mobilized over 22,000 youth and have trained over 500 youth leaders in being able to lobby and advocate and network with their elected officials on the local and the state level. And currently we are now a national organization affecting both state and federal level policy.
And when you talk about advocacy and young people, what do you mean?
So Generation Z and millennials, specifically Generation Z, is an extremely vocal, present-minded set of individuals. And what Our Climate likes to do is we have both fellowship and field representative programs. And through our core curriculum, which consists of climate policy, climate advocacy, lobbying, democracy, storytelling, we give them the skill set of leadership development and policy advocacy. And then have them have these lobby days, which are now virtual because we're all experiencing the COVID-19 pandemic, but to give them a chance to advocate on behalf of certain bills, certain policies, or whether it's the issue as a whole of climate change, and really being able to utilize that storytelling skill set and break it down for these elected officials of how it affects them, even in their own backyard.
So you're not like Extinction Rebellion and you go out on the streets and you hold up placards, you advocate. And I know this is one of the things you do. I read you have about over 1,500 student-led conversations with lawmakers. Mm-hmm. Now that's quite incredible, having young people engaging with lawmakers. Tell us about that and how that works, because that's quite something.
Yeah, so after we have really trained our youth on how they should approach these conversations, so it's giving them the background of climate policy, specifically in the United States, and breaking it down for them on the state level. So Our Climate is located in six states, Oregon, Washington, Nebraska, Florida, Massachusetts, and New York. And then we have some students sprinkled across the United States. So we really teach them about what's going on specifically in the state that they are a fellow or a field representative on, and then teach them the different steps for when you go into those meetings with elected officials, being able to give them a few facts, but then also making it personal for them and telling them your own climate story. And we have found that very successful. The elected officials very much want to talk to the youth. That is a generation that they're open to speaking with.
And do you have any evidence that talking works and you change their minds?
The evidence is that we have passed several pieces of legislation. Most recently in Massachusetts, we were able to pass where environmental justice communities are defined in a law. We've also been part of the CLCPA, which was in New York, and that was with our coalition, New York Renews.
And do you think that the success is partly to do with the fact you train people? You don't just mobilize, you train them, and you give them the skill set to be able to talk the language that lawmakers understand.
Very much so, very much so. I think that it's very important to teach people the mechanics of different things, and then have them, it's kind of the train the trainer model. And so that's why when our fellows are done and they graduate through the fellowship program, they can then go on to become field advisors, and they mentor new youth who have become fellows. And them being able to practice this. In fact, we have a blog post coming out of one of those youths who attended our policy camp last year. And now she was able to lead a breakout session during our policy camp that was 2 weekends ago. And so to see her develop as an individual, but also be able to become this lifelong climate advocate and pass this on to her peers and to her family and friends, and be able to connect the climate justice movement to all the other movements that are going on as well right now.
So when you get these people, I mean, those 1500 conversations, all the people you're involved with, where do you find them from?
Where do we find them? Well, people hear about our climate word of mouth. They tap on our website, they see the social media. And I think it's important to know that for us, it's going into the schools. So whether that's high schools, community colleges, universities, including HBCUs, those are historically Black colleges and universities. It's really important for us to make those connections in academia, because we want to make sure that our network is as diverse as possible, and also exposing people to the various professions that people work in on climate change.
And you don't just work with students, do you? You work with other organizations. And I mean, is that an important lesson to learn, that if you're involved in the climate change debate, that you must work in partnership with others? And I know that you, from reading about you, you have 15 national environmental and social justice organizations you work with. How do you do that?
Really, it's through conversation. So it's having, which I've been doing for the past month, in my first month of the job, it's having those one-on-one or small group conversations on what is that organization currently doing, and seeing how does that match up to your mission. And then also seeing how can you all collaborate? Because one thing I've learned is that it's not about the individual, but it's about the group. And so the more people that you have involved in it, then the bigger your movement can become, and the more that your issue can become accepted. So it's very important to make sure that you are learning how to become a collaborative partner in this space. Because I think that stretches the movement across states, across countries, and around the world.
That sounds very sort of calculated and rational, but isn't there an element of in it that if people are enthusiastic, they just want to get together and you just sort of dive in and work together?
I think yes, that's the usual yes.
Yeah, and then we say we thought about it rationally, didn't we? But we get together and we do those things, which is great. I mean, one of the things we said we'd talk about, because you're very concerned about it, is that climate change, which is clearly going to happen and is happening currently, affects people of colour more than it affects anyone else, or disproportionately affects them. Do you want to explain why you think that is?
Yeah. So specifically in the United States, communities of color have been battling environmental injustices for decades. And the question is, why are we still fighting for this? Why is this something that has not had solutions? And one of those things is that communities of color, including these community leaders, have not been brought to the table when these policy decisions have been made. And so that's something very important for us to be doing now, especially as we're in this moment of racial unrest, COVID-19 pandemic, the climate change crisis, and an economy that is unfortunate right now, I'll put it that way. And so communities of color around the world and in the United States are constantly, it's not that we do not care about climate change, because the studies show that communities of color do care about climate change and can tell you about climate change, but it's the fact that we are not able to focus on that, because at least in America, I will speak about that because it's personal for me, the moment we walk outside of our houses, we're deemed a threat to society because of the color of our skin. And so it's very important for me in a personal mission for us to be able to reach out to communities of color, find out what the issues are from them. What are they seeing? Because they can tell you about the environment in their own community more so than you can, even as a knowledgeable scientist in this field. And I think it's very important for us to understand the various cultures, specifically, you know, when you're speaking with indigenous communities and the history in this country, there has been an ostracization of communities of color for hundreds of years. The country was founded upon taking away land from indigenous peoples and built upon the backs of slaves who were brought over from other countries. And then you had the indentured slaves on the railroads, and the Japanese in the internment camps, and the Latinos who are currently being thrown into cages. And so it's very important for us to make sure that we are acknowledging the struggles that these communities have gone through in this country and the history that is there. One other thing I'd like to say in this regard is a prime example of this is redlining. The history of redlining in this country actually started in 1934, and that came out of the New Deal Act, in which this was creating new housing communities for people, and primarily the middle class. But then, what did that turn into? It turned into segregation of your African Americans and Latinx communities, then, and other communities of color being separated from the white communities. And these redlined communities were set into places where there was known bad environmental air quality or sitting next to landfills. And this is still going on. You know, you have people who are passing down multi-generational wealth and ownership, you know, grandparents who are giving their houses to their grandkids, and it's still sitting next to this landfill. And so that struggle is there of, how do we bring this up? How do we talk about this? How do we come up with different solutions? I think it's very important for us to know that the intersecting effects of climate change all disproportionately impact communities of color. And those intersecting effects, it's not just the environmental or the economical side, which is what we mostly talk about when we talk about climate change, but there's the racial, the housing, the migration, the sociocultural, the food insecurity. And so all of these, if you take them separately, communities of color around the world are disproportionately impacted. And so then when you put all of those in a bucket and put climate change on top of it, it's this huge disproportion. And so we have got to come up with various solutions in how we are going to address this.
Okay, so Black Lives Matter and that's about many issues, but it is about climate change as well. How do you, I mean, all the things you said about poverty and people being in redlined housing and being next to incinerators and landfills and so on, how do you combine all this together with climate change to get that message across to engage the people that are in those situations?
For me, it's all about storytelling. But one thing that I personally relate to is if we take migration, for instance. I grew up in Louisiana. My state was hit hard by Hurricane Katrina. And so you had hundreds of people who then had to leave their homes, leave their culture, move away from Louisiana, and still to this day have not been back because of the trauma that it instilled upon them. Some of these same people moved to Houston, Texas, which was affected by major flooding. And so they have lost their homes not once, but twice due to climate. So this is climate migration. And you're now having this huge movement, which it was going to happen. The last time this movement happened in the United States was in the 60s. But this time it's different. You're having a combination of the pandemic, racial unrest, and the climate change crisis. And to see this combination of where people are finally starting to talk about this intersecting or intersectional connection between environmental justice and racial justice in this country, I think we're starting to get some headway there. We have so much work to do. The Black Lives Matter movement, some people have tried to label it as bad, but it really the movement is just about speaking up and saying that Black Lives Matter too. This is not to put us above. This is saying that we matter as well. And this is not something new. This is something that we have been going on and talking about in our own communities for decades. The conversations that we have with our children now are some of the same conversations that our grandparents had with our parents. And that's not something that they wanted. And so, now we're trying to figure out how are we going to solve this? Are we actually going to put in some change to dismantle the systemic racism that has occurred both environmentally and across industries, professionally, it's there as well. So I hope we make some changes in this regard.
You have two sort of audiences you're aiming at. That's the communities who are suffering and getting them to realize that, climate change will affect them. But that's difficult, isn't it? Because they are facing survival problems day after day and thinking about that sometimes is far off. And then you've got the politicians who are often white and who don't understand that. Now, how do you deal with those two audiences and bridge the gap?
I think it's really important by bringing those two sets of audiences together. And one of those ways is just by having conversations. So some of the times it's by providing guidance. For example, for our climate leaders, providing guidance for them on how to have those conversations and bring those two forces together. What if you're someone from, a community of color who has been suffering? And it's being able to tell your story. It's making it personal for them. It's showing them that there are connections between their suffering and the overall suffering of the country. If we are not all trying to prosper and to continue to grow and excel this country, then you're going to see this disproportionate percentage of the population continuing to suffer. And one thing I will say is that communities of color are very resilient people. And so this is something that is across borders. You see this. And we will continue to tell our stories. We will continue to advocate and to fight on behalf of each other. I think for these elected officials, it's important for you to show them, specifically here in the United States, if you're speaking to your senator from Massachusetts, talk with them what's going on in Massachusetts. If you're talking to, your mayor in New York City, it's important about talking to them how how this is affecting New York City and how if you bring in more green jobs, this is only going to help New York City's economy. This is going to help people get back on their feet. And so I think it's important for us to do that.
Okay. One of the other things, and you mentioned it in one of your answers, is your concern, I know, is about the fact that climate change will increase migration, both internally within the USA and internally with other countries and internationally as well. And that's going to be one of the biggest problems. I mean, we're facing the problem of migration now, and people are, and there's a backlash to it. But what we're seeing now is nothing compared to what will happen in the future. I mean, how do you get that message over? And how do you get people to prepare for that so that they can manage that? And can they manage that?
Mm-hmm. So let me throw out a few facts for you. Unpredictable monsoon rainfall in Southeast Asia, increasing storm surges and hurricanes in the United States and the Caribbean, drought in the African Sahel, major wildfires in Australia and the west coast of the United States. And oh, by the way, the Amazon is burning away. You know, these are the things that we've seen literally just in the past few months. Migration has happened since the beginning of time. The difference now is that the amount of migration increases substantially as climate changes. So climate is rarely the main cause of migration. However, it most always exacerbates it. Climate extremes such as droughts don't simply result in no water, but rather crop losses, unemployment, poverty, community tension. And then where do the migrants go? Do they have anywhere to go? This ties into the refugee world and how across borders, there are very few and little protections for people who have been displaced by climate change. Not to mention, with the combination of the COVID-19 pandemic and countries around the world not welcoming migrants and this no worldwide protection for people displaced by climate change, what should we do? You know, is this something that we're bringing up on the UN level? And one other thing is that of all of the people displaced by climate change, how many of those people are women? 80% of the population displaced by climate change is women, and women face higher economical, political, and social barriers than men do in order to recover from climate disasters. So when we talk about climate migration, this is affecting all of us, and the countries that are being affected the most by climate change right now are trying to get to countries that are also being affected, but it might be a safer place for them. They might be able to get back on their feet. They might be able to help with the economy. And yet we're seeing where these people are not being accepted. We're seeing where we want to close our borders. And so this is something that has got to be fixed. It has to be solved. But we are all going to be affected by it, because think of the major populations and where do those live? You know, you think about India, that's around a coast. You think about Indonesia, you think about Bangladesh. And so we have got to think about this on a high level in how we are going to solve this crisis, because it's only going to get worse as the climate keeps increasing.
How do you solve that problem? Because you know, in America, and we've seen it in Europe, we've seen it in this country, we've had a populist reaction, Trump in your country, to migration. And you know, the Trump constituency, some people call it the redneck constituency, they won't take that message very kindly. They will find the idea of more migration happening abhorrent to them, because they may not understand the mechanics of it. Now, do you feel you have a need to convince that audience as well that this problem will affect us all?
Very much so. I think one of the things with audiences in regards to climate migration specifically and climate change as a whole is humanizing the issue. We have politicized this, and it's not a political issue. It's a human issue. And you know, we often like to think of things at the 30,000 foot level and not have it on the micro level. We don't like to think about how this has affected a family. Think of your neighbor. Your neighbor's a farmer, and a drought has been going on for months. So now they weren't able to bring in the crops that they were expecting. And now they're having to ask for loans. And now it's gotten to a point where they're going to have to leave the farm behind and sell it. And the proceeds from the sale is that it is going back to the bank on the loans. And now they're having to find a new place to stay. And all that trauma that a human being is going through is something that we have to address. So it's involving people from multiple sectors, being able to come to the table and have conversations about this and talk about how we cannot ostracize people. We've got to welcome them in. We've got to figure out ways in which we are enacting protection status for them. And climate change is a real issue that is affecting people because, in addition to the climate change that is occurring, again, I said it's only exacerbating issues that are already going on. So you have that community tension. You might have drought, you might have war. And we have got to be able to sit around and we have to put pressure on our elected officials that this is a real issue and it matters because it's a human issue. It's not a political issue.
Well, I think what you said about we should humanize it and not politicize it is a really, really important point, which I think lots of people will have a great deal of empathy with you on. But can you humanize it to the scale needed to make a difference? Can you tell stories enough for people to relate to it? And are you not afraid that events will take over and drown those humanized ways of doing things in those stories you tell?
This is where I think it's important for our youth. We talked about a little bit about the youth climate movement, and Generation Z is extremely vocal, and they are talking about climate change and all of these intersecting effects. I think that they are going to hold everyone accountable because we are talking about the futures of our grandchildren and great grandchildren. And so, yes, it's at the level where it has to be at that high scale. And you see progress when you put pressure on elected officials, when you make sure that it's being talked about. So you're having the conversations at the dinner table, you're putting it on social media. You're having the uncomfortable conversation with your neighbor, who is very conservative in this regard. And it's important to do that. And just it's throwing yourself out there, but at the same time, it's for the common good.
So that means being open about what's happening, being open about the communities that are affected, being open about race, for example, talking about those things. And that's your message. That's the mission of your organization, is it?
Yes. So, our climate, we empower our youth to advocate for science-based and equitable climate policy solutions. It is very important for us. We have three policy principles, and so they are focused on renewable energy targets, corporate polluter fees, and environmental justice legislation. So by utilizing these policy principles, we are able to talk about climate change as a whole and really advocate for change and make sure that revenue is going back into the communities who have been most impacted.
Okay, well, we're getting very close to the end of our 30 minutes and it's gone incredibly quickly. How do you see your future? You're 1 month into a new job, which is exciting and fun, and you always go into a job full of ideas, and then you hit reality. Where would you like to be? What would you like to see your organization to do in terms of the mission you've got, and how successful do you think you can be?
So when I returned to the United States after finishing my graduate studies, I have been in environmental justice for about a decade now. And this organization that I'm working for, I have been completely inspired by because the youth have this energy about them. something that I only have a little bit left of. So it keeps me invigorated each and every single day. I foresee our climate being one of the phone calls from the White House, from the UN, in speaking about these climate policy solutions. I see our climate being the bridge between the local, state, and national levels. Climate change legislation is going to happen on the federal level in the next year or two, and in the United States, especially if we see a different administration, you know, in the White House. And I think this will also affect the world as well, because then we can get back to being on the same page with the Paris Climate Agreement and making sure that cities around the world are making sure that they are providing a better future for the generations that are already existing and ones to come.
Okay, well, it sounds to me as you don't have just a little energy left, you have a heck of a lot of energy left. So I'm sure you're going to have a great, great future in the job you're doing. So if anybody wanted to find out more about what you're doing and about you and about your organization, where would they go?
Yeah, so if you head to our website, www.ourclimate.us, you can reach us there. And you can also find us on social media as Our Climate Leaders on Instagram and also on Facebook.
Okay, well, that's clear. Well, thank you very much. I mean, that's been a great interview, and I think lots of people will find it interesting, because what you're doing in terms of engaging young people and linking them in with the decision-making process is really important, and I'm sure we could learn a lot from you and get a lot of advice from you, and maybe people will contact you, maybe we will as well, to get advice from you, because I think what you're doing is great. So, you know, thank you for taking part in this. Thank you for doing it, and good luck in your new job. I'm sure it'll be fantastic.
So, thank you so much.
So we'll end this interview now.